Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, A Way Out of the War on Drugs?
This book is really a book that is trying to highlight our hypocrisy in terms of our drug policy and in terms of how we're enforcing our drug laws. And I'm trying to show people what the tremendous costs are to our current practices and how our current practices are inconsistent with the original promise of the country, that is, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for its citizens.
That's Carl Hart. We talk with him about his book, Drug Use for Grown-Ups, Chasing Liberty in the Land of Fear. We also talk with Harith Ziad about their memoir, Black Boy Out of Time. It's about growing up black and queer in Cleveland, Ohio. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon.
I am an unapologetic drug user. I take drugs as a part of my pursuit of happiness, and they work. I am a happier and better person because of them. I am also a scientist and a professor of psychology, specializing in neuroscience at Columbia University, known for my work on drug abuse and addiction. It has taken me more than 2 decades to come out of the closet about my personal drug use. Simply put, I have been a coward.
That's Carl Hart reading from his book, Drug Use for Grown-Ups. Judging from the reaction to his book, it took an extraordinary amount of courage for him to come out about his recreational use of drugs. He's had to endure outrage and disbelief at his suggestion that drugs, from cannabis to heroin and cocaine, can be used responsibly by adults without physical or psychological harm, much less addiction. Yet Hart comes to his position through decades of respected research into drugs and their impact on human health. He's a professor of psychology in the departments of psychology and psychiatry at Columbia University. He's also a research scientist at the New York State Psychiatric Institute. Dr. Hart has published numerous scientific and popular articles in the area of neuropsychopharmacology and is the co-author of the textbook Drugs, Society, and Human Behavior. So if anyone has the credentials to say drugs can be used responsibly, it's Carl Hart. Far more dangerous than the use of drugs, Hart maintains, is the war on drugs, which has resulted in the mass incarceration of millions of our citizens, disproportionately people of color. Drug use for grown-ups is not only an impeccably laid out scientific case for legalizing drugs, it's a passionate critique of the institutional groupthink that condemns them and the racist injustice system of the war on drugs. Well, Carl Hart, welcome to Writer's Voice. This book, Drug Use for Grown-Ups, you clearly state in the first sentence that it is not a book promoting drug use. Yet I've watched other interviews that you've had, and I've seen your frustration sometimes when the interviewers keep seeming to imply that that's exactly what you're doing. So just so we get that out of the way, what's this book for, and who is this book for?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. This book is really a book that is trying to highlight our hypocrisy in terms of our drug policy and in terms of how we're enforcing our drug laws. And I'm trying to show people what the tremendous costs are to our current practices and how our current practices are inconsistent with the original promise of the country, that is, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for its citizens.
You know, it seems to me that people have a hard time wrapping their minds around the idea that there's more than just either condemning drugs or promoting them. I want to get back to this idea of the pursuit of happiness, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But before we go further, You're a neuroscientist. You're a professor of neuroscience and psychology at Columbia University. Just briefly tell our listeners a bit about your work, your research in this area, so we get a sense of the background and the knowledge that you bring to this.
Yeah, for more than 30 years, I have been studying the effects of drugs on the human brain, on animals, and just on behavior. And so what that means is that I bring people into the lab and I give them various drugs like cocaine, methamphetamine, marijuana, and I carefully study their effects long after the drug is over, the immediate effects of the drugs, in an effort to help us understand what drugs do and what drugs don't do.
You've traveled a long way since you first started 30 years ago. Talk a little bit about that trajectory that you've traveled.
Yeah, when I first started studying drugs in the late 80s, early 90s, my ideas were that drugs were bad. And I thought that if I could understand the brain better, I would be able to understand drug addiction treatment better. And maybe I could come up with cures that would help people who were struggling with drug addiction, because I believed at the time drugs were destroying the communities from which I came. These communities were resource poor, oftentimes shut out of the American dream. And I thought this was all occurring because of drug addiction or the drug trade. But over the time that I have been studying drugs, I've come to realize that I was wrong. And there were certainly other factors that were involved in those communities not doing well. Factors like lack of employment, lack of opportunities, poor education, isolation, racial discrimination. All of these things were at play, but I blame drugs for the problems that I saw. But like you would expect, over a long career, you hope that people figure things out and you hope that they use data, evidence to support their positions that they arrive at.
Well, you're unusual in this field. Why do you think that so many scientists have persisted with a kind of groupthink around drugs?
I think that there are several reasons that that occurs. I think, number one, it's difficult to go against convention because then you're isolated, you're on your own, and you come up against a lot of opposition when you don't have to if you have the position that everyone else has. Another reason I think a number of scientists choose not to take this position or be as vocal about this position is because we have to understand that science, most scientists come from middle-class white families in the United States. And those communities have not been as affected by what we thought were drug problems. And those communities have not paid the price in terms of high incarceration rates. And so I have this added pressure to think about what has been the cost of our current drug policies on my communities, on people who live in those communities. And so all of these sorts of things force me to really reckon with these issues on a regular basis. And I don't think other scientists bump up against this in their daily lives like I do.
Yeah, you know, Carl Hart, in this book, Drug Use for Grownups, I mean, what you've just said and in the whole book, you really weave together a narrative of science, of policy, but also of racism and the history of racism as it impacts the development of policy. I mean, like so much else, it seems like our attitudes towards drugs in this country seem distorted by racism and our racial narratives.
Yeah, the documentary filmmaker Kim Burns once said that no matter what endeavor you're looking at in this country, if you're not looking at race, then you're probably missing the mark. Of course, I'm paraphrasing. And drug science, drug policy, drug law enforcement, all of those endeavors take place within the American context. And if you're within the American context, you have to think about our history of slavery, subjugation of certain groups. And why would anybody expect drug science or drug policy to be different from every other endeavor in our society? That is, why would anybody expect race not to play a role when you have humans participating in this endeavor?
Yeah. Could you give us an example of that? I mean, take a drug like heroin, or take a drug like marijuana. How did the racial narrative inform the way we deal with these drugs, even just starting historically?
Yeah, if we think about this historically, most Americans think drugs are banned because of the unique dangers they pose, because of their pharmacology. But when in fact, drugs are banned because good old American racism. Let's take cocaine, for example. At the turn of the 20th century, cocaine was legal in this country. It was in a number of products, including Coca-Cola. And then about late 1800s, actually, this occurred when Coca-Cola decided to bottle their product. Previously, it was only in the fountain drinks. And the fountain is Black people were not allowed to sit at the fountain and order drinks. And so Coca-Cola was primarily available only to white people. But when Coca-Cola decided to bottle it, now Black people had access to Coca-Cola. We started to see these stories appearing in the media, in the medical literature, connecting some heinous act or behavior to Black people and the use of cocaine. So they were claiming that Black people behaved inappropriately when they were on cocaine, so much so that we should be worried about Black men who are going to rape white women. And then they would tell stories about the cocainized Negro drug fiend who had taken cocaine. And then when the sheriff unloaded his .32 caliber weapon into this person's heart, this person continued to come at the sheriff and attack the sheriff. Stories like that led to Southern police forces to move to a higher caliber weapon. And these stories also contributed to the federal government banning drugs like cocaine and opium-based products. Those were the first laws that were passed in 1914. Before that, passing a national law to inhibit or to prevent drug use was unheard of. But these stories of Black people and also Asian people with opium, these stories of these undesired groups using psychoactive substances were enough to encourage Congress to pass legislation restricting access to these drugs.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Carl Hart about his book, Drug Use for Grown-Ups. He is a neuroscientist and a professor of psychology at Columbia University. Yeah, so now to the war on drugs, which you've just introduced there. You say that the war on drugs hasn't been a complete failure. It's only failed to rid us of drugs. So in what way has it not been a failure?
Yeah, the war on drugs, a number of people in our country are fond of saying that the war on drugs has been a failure. It has not. Otherwise, it would not be continued decade after decade after decade. The war on drugs currently functions as a sort of a jobs program. The war on drugs, every year we spend about $40 billion to support this war. And the bulk of these funds go to law enforcement agencies, go to prison authorities. And so those industries are always hiring, and the war on drugs allowed them to do so. And there are industries like hotels and restaurants that are near prisons where loved ones of the inmates have to frequent these businesses. And so when we are arresting, for example, 1.5 million Americans every year for simply possessing drugs,
it's in the service of this war on drugs, and it's also in the service of those industries who are making money on the war on drugs. So for them, the war on drugs has been a boon.
So now let's go back to the Declaration of Independence. I found this such an interesting way that you use this concept. You talk about the foundation of liberty is a pursuit of happiness. That's what really is kind of enshrined in our Declaration of Independence. And you apply it to your approach to taking drugs. Connect the dots.
Yeah. One of the things that I was forced to do in the course of writing this book is to look at the founding documents of this country. And the Declaration of Independence, I was struck by because of the profound, noble ideas articulated in it. And it's a short document. But number one, or chief among them, is this idea that every American citizen has by birthright at least three important rights: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It simply means that we can live our life as we see fit, so long as we don't prevent others from doing the same. And then the very next sentence, it says that government should be created to secure these rights, not restrict them. And so that's inconsistent with how we have been handling drugs in this country and people's desire to alter their consciousness. And so I know the Declaration is not law. That's the thing that makes it's so beautiful. It's the ideal, and it's the ideal towards which we are striving. And I wanted to remind people that this is what it means to be American. That is, being able to live your life as you see fit, so long as you don't bother others or prevent others from doing the same. And so when we think of drug use in that context, it seems that drug use, personal drug use, is a protected right that the government seems obliged to secure and protect. But we have not lived up to the promise, or our practice is not consistent with our promise. So I hope that helps the reader to challenge, think about this and other activities or other inconsistencies in our society.
And I can imagine, the people may say, well, but it drug cause a lot of harm. I mean, I personally remember when a kid in my son's high school class died of an overdose. I mean, we have hundreds of thousands of people who have died from drug overdoses. Talk about heroin in particular. Now, I know that you use heroin. You speak about it in the book. You also say that somebody in a clinic in Geneva, Switzerland, told you that heroin is one of the safest drugs there is. So tell us, why are so many people dying from it if this is so safe?
Yeah, thank you. There's a lot to unpack in that question. First of all, one of the things I try to do in the book is I try to re-educate the reader in terms of what they've been told about drugs like heroin. So when we think of heroin, heroin and morphine are essentially the same drug. Heroin is morphine with two acid groups attached to it. And those acid groups don't really do anything biologically. So heroin is essentially morphine. Morphine comes from the opium poppy. So does opium and codeine. And so heroin is just another opioid. Now, can people get addicted to heroin or other opioids? Absolutely, yes. Just like they can get addicted to alcohol. And so when we think of heroin, however, we think of heroin as being uniquely more dangerous than all these other drugs. And that's a fallacy. And I'm trying to show the reader that most of the dangers associated with heroin comes from the fact that the drug is illegal and obtained from illicit markets. That is, the heroin that's obtained illegally oftentimes is tainted, The quality varies widely. You don't know if you're going to get 5% heroin or 80% heroin, which makes it a dangerous proposition because you might take too much, thinking that you have a lower concentration of heroin. And you also are exposed to a world in which you have to be paranoid about the police, paranoid about the people with whom you are interacting. All of these sort of conditions increase the dangers of heroin, but these dangers are not the drug itself, but it's the conditions which we have created by forcing people to be underground with their heroin use. We've created these conditions by stigmatizing heroin use so much. And now the goal here is not to encourage people to take heroin. The goal here is to help people to step back and evaluate what's really going on. When we think about heroin overdoses, for example, overdoses from opioids that we typically think of, OxyContin, morphine, heroin, overdoses from a single opioid is kind of difficult to do. There are few of those cases. Most people who overdose from what people have termed heroin overdoses, they have overdoses because they combine heroin or some other opioid with another sedative, like an antihistamine, like promethazine, or like with alcohol, or like with a benzodiazepine, like Xanax. When you combine heroin or other opioids with other sedatives, you increase the likelihood of respiratory depression. And so I'm trying to help the reader to understand that. And hopefully people would be less likely to mix opioids with other sedatives. And but this kind of information isn't generally provided to the public. Another reason that people die from what we have termed a heroin overdose is that they get tainted drug. That is, they may think they have heroin when in fact they have a more potent opioid like fentanyl or a fentanyl analog. And if they take fentanyl in the same amounts that they usually take their heroin, it increases the likelihood that they will overdose because fentanyl is so much more potent, that is requiring less amount to produce an effect. It is so much more potent than heroin. It increases the likelihood of overdose. And so one way we can deal with that simple problem is to make sure that we have these drug checking facilities where people can submit small samples of their drugs anonymously and receive a chemical printout of what the drug actually contains. And if it contains a contaminant that's potentially dangerous, you don't take it. But this information or these services are not available in the United States. They are available in Europe, in places like Spain and Austria, the Netherlands, and even Colombia. And so these things that people think are problems of heroin or related to heroin, it's not. It's these other issues that occur as a result of our draconian drug policy.
Carl Hart, in this book, In Drug Use for Grownups, you challenge the notion that regular, what you call responsible drug use, causes brain damage. This is a common idea for, you know, a lot of drugs. But what about the impacts of drugs on growing brains, on adolescent brains? I mean, for example, cannabis or alcohol. I mean, I have seen a lot of studies that say that they impact the brains of adolescents that are growing so quickly. So I wonder if you could address that.
Yeah, so when people ask questions like, do drugs change the brain or the functioning of brains? Of course, this conversation changes the functioning of my brain. And if there is some sort of learning here, it's going to change permanently. The real question is, do drugs change your brains in a pathological manner? And so far, the evidence that we have, regular, typical recreational drug use, there is no evidence to support that the notion that drugs alter people's brains in a negative way, and in a long-term fashion. And I go through the evidence to show people this. But people ask the question also, what about on the developing brain? That's a good question. We never ask that question, by the way, when we administer to children attention deficit disorder medications like amphetamines or antidepressant medications or medications to treat asthma. All of these medications we give to children who may be afflicted with one of these disorders. But we never ask that question. One of the things that's important to understand that is that we make sure we attend to the dose when we give a drug to a child. We make sure we cut the dose to be lower than that of someone who is an adult or someone who weighs more. The same can be true when we think about marijuana use on an adolescent's brain. The book doesn't really deal with adolescents, but this notion that drug use negatively alters brain functioning on the developing brain, there is almost no evidence to support that statement. And in the book, I go through how so-called neuroscientists mislead the public with statements suggesting that the drug use is negatively altering the brains of users. And this is a delicate issue because there might be evidence that's generated in the future that actually shows that. But at this moment in our history in 2021, there is virtually no evidence to support such statements.
Well, you said the dose. That's very important when you're thinking about taking drugs. And of course, when you're talking about adolescent smoking pot, having been one back in the day, you know, the dose was pretty much up to me. It wasn't up to, you know, a doctor or a pharmacist where I was getting it. So how should one approach responsible drug use? Well, obviously in adults, but also in adolescents, in teenagers who, you know, many of them, if not most of them, are trying drugs like this.
Yeah, so you should also know that I've raised children, too. My youngest is 20 now. And so, of course, as a parent, I have to deal with this sort of thing. When we think about children or adolescents, the three drugs that they are most likely to have tried or try are alcohol, tobacco, and marijuana. Given that that's the case, our drug education should focus primarily on those drugs for that age group. And when we think about alcohol, the major problems or concern with alcohol is that people take too much in a setting and they pass out. They can actually die from vomiting too much or being unconscious. So you want to make sure that your children understand what the signs of alcohol poisoning are. You know, people would initially hopefully vomit. And then if you continue to put alcohol in the person's system, in their body, that's not a good thing. So you want to make sure your children understands that the vomiting is a clue that something is going wrong here and you need to stop it and maybe get help at that point. With tobacco smoking, one of the major things that we were concerned about as parents is our kids have asthma. And so I just didn't really want my kids really sucking burning weeds down their throat because it would make them more susceptible to having an asthma attack. And you also want your kids to understand that tobacco nicotine is probably is actually the most addictive substance that we use. About a third of the users become addicted to that substance. And the earlier you start, it increases the likelihood that you will be one of those victims. But that has more to do with the lack of supervision that the folks who are smoking tobacco at an early age are not getting, the supervision they're not getting. So that has a lot to do with their environment. And so parents should just be vigilant about what activities their kids are engaged in, and not, they shouldn't overreact, but just be vigilant. And then the next one is cannabis. The major concern that I have with cannabis for young people is that cannabis can really increase anxiety and paranoia in inexperienced users, particularly if they take too much. And so you just want to reinforce with your children, look, if you're going to do this kind of thing, don't take a whole lot, you know, take it slowly. That's the major thing that we should be emphasizing. And if you get anxious, it's okay. Just be relaxed. Don't panic because it's a drug and it interacts with a receptor and it will eventually float away from the receptor and you will calm down and return back to normal. That is a normal process. It may take several hours, but just trust that the drug will float away. That would alleviate so much stress and anxiety and paranoia among kids if they just simply knew that sort of thing. And also, they need to know that if they take cannabis in the oral form, edibles, the effects will take a lot longer to be detected. It might take up to an hour and a half before the individual even feels anything. And so, given that that's the case, don't continue to put the drug in your body. Just wait, because if you continue to put the drug in your body, when the effects come on, they are going to be overwhelming and you will really feel like you're in trouble. And some people feel like they're dying. And so you want children to understand these primary effects of these three drugs. If they understand that, it decreases the likelihood they will panic if something goes wrong with themselves or with their friends.
Carl Hart, we've talked about adolescents using cannabis. You've said there's no evidence of harm to the adolescent brain, at least so far. I've seen reports that more older people are using cannabis. What might be some health concerns for older people using it? For example, I've heard that there's an impact on the heart, on speeding up the heart rate. Could that be a problem?
When we think about something like cannabis, one of the most consistent effects that observed at the cannabis use is this dramatic increase in heart rate. And so when I think about cannabis use as we get older, I certainly try to stress to people that heart health is critically important because of cannabis' consistent effects on in terms of increasing heart rate. When we think about drug use among young healthy people can certainly take a lot more than, say, as I get older. I can't do alcohol in the way that I used to be able to do alcohol. As a young person, my body just doesn't recover like that. And so I had to pretty much knock alcohol out of my drug using repertoire because of my aging body. And that's a normal process. As we age, we alter our diets. So why wouldn't we alter our drug use? It's important that we attend to these things. And so I think it's important for people to really listen to their bodies. When we think about research studies, a lot of times we are talking about the impact of these drugs on people who are from age 21 to maybe 55. Those are the age groups that we study in the lab. And people who fall outside of that age bracket, we know less information about. But you as a person, you have to attend to your own body. And you can figure out these effects. For example, you know that you, I don't know, can't do dairy in the same way you used to can do dairy. The same is true with drugs. So you take it slowly and you before increasing doses and you see how you feel.
Well, Carl Hart, I have so enjoyed talking with you and enjoyed reading this book, Drug Use for Grownups. It's not only filled with information and very thought-provoking, it's also a real terrific read. Thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me, Frances. I really dig what you do, so thank you.
Next up, we talk with Harith Iyad about their healing memoir of growing up black and queer in a family of Hare Krishna adherents. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. One of 19 children in a blended family, Harith Iyad was raised by a Hindu Hare Krishna mother and a Muslim father. In their memoir, Black Boy Out of Time, Ziad takes readers on a powerful journey of growing up queer and black in Cleveland, Ohio, and of navigating the equally complex path toward finding their true self in New York City. Exploring childhood, gender, race, and trust that's built, broken, and repaired through generations, Ziad investigates what it means to live beyond the limited narratives black children are given. Well, Harith Iyad, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So we are talking about your memoir, Black Boy Out of Time. And I want to ask you about the title. The black boy is self-evident, but what about the out of time?
Yeah, so out of time refers to two different things. Initially, I was thinking about time in a linear fashion and what that means for inner child work. So in the book, inner child work and reconnecting with your younger self is really heavily a part of it. And I think it's a part of the healing work that Black people in general need to do. And so I was thinking of out of time as being like a rejection of, you know, time only works in one way. We can't go back and reclaim aspects of ourselves, our past. I wanted to reject that whole framework. But also, especially after my mother was diagnosed with a terminal and untreatable cancer, I was thinking about the urgency of this type of healing work. And that even if we're not out of time yet, we have to start on that now. It should be incorporated in our everyday practice. And so the out of time also refers to just how urgent it is to heal through the things that we as Black people face in this world.
Well, you've already introduced a whole lot that I wanted to talk about, and I guess we might as well just dive in first. I mean, this is very much a memoir about healing. So for those of our listeners who don't know about inner child work, tell us what it is and how you came to it.
So inner child work, and this is very broad strokes. I'm not a psychologist, so take this as someone who's learned it from other sources, but inner child work is the process of engaging the aspects of yourself that might represent your childhood self. And a lot of times that is a part of yourself that you might not be aware of is even actually existing. That part of yourself can present through your anxiety or other things that are coming out of a place of your childhood that you might have had some childhood traumas that are unaddressed. And it is rooted in the idea that you can reparent that aspect of yourself. So if you did go through trauma, you're working with that part of yourself and actually like externalizing that part of yourself, communicating and talking directly to that part of yourself and listening to what that part of yourself is telling you in order to build a healthier relationship. I learned about it in therapy, dealing with my own childhood traumas, in particular, the relationship with my mother and how my queerness was responded to and what that meant. And as we were talking about our relationship going forward and when she was diagnosed with cancer, so much of that healing had to do with experiences in childhood. And so inner child work became a big part of just my whole grieving process. And then eventually, ultimately became a part of the book.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Harees Iyad about his memoir, Black Boy Out of Time. It's about growing up queer and gay in Cleveland, Ohio, to a family of Hare Krishna devotees. So tell us about your mother. First of all, you came from a very unusual family, religiously speaking, and that's a huge part of this. I mean, your mother and your grandmother were both adherents of the Hare Krishna denomination, I guess, Hinduism. And you have 18 siblings and 19 kids in your family. Talk about your family a bit. Give us a sense of what it was like.
So, like you mentioned, my mother and her mother converted to Hinduism when my mother was about 20. And my mother has 10 kids herself, and my father had 12, and together they had 3. So it's 19 of us. But my mother converted before she had her first children, and she was very busy for a lot of years. And so there's different generations of us. And so by the time I was born, my mother was part of this movement for about 20 years and was actually a big part of the movement. She kind of was like a minister figure and went through a lot of things as a Black woman, converting into the Hare Krishna religion and Hinduism and at large, especially during that time. It wasn't something that was really heard of. But my mother and her mother like created a lot of space for Black people to access this religion. And that was part of their journey through a lot of different religions growing up. My grandmother had also explored the Seventh-day Adventist Church and different versions of Christianity, as well as the Nation of Islam. So I feel like they were always on a journey spiritually together. And my mother met my father early in life, but didn't marry him until well later. And he was a part of the Nation of Islam, and that's actually how he met my grandmother. And so it was an interesting experience growing up with two faiths, but I mostly grew up in the Hare Krishna community. We would go to the mosque with my father sometimes, but I was raised primarily Hindu. And my mother also homeschooled us. So a lot of our time growing up was spent in the Hare Krishna community exclusively almost, which is really interesting. And even when I was growing up, there still weren't too many Black devotees, but there were quite a few more. And that was primarily through the work of my mother and grandmother, who did a lot of building of the Hare Krishna community in Cleveland.
And also you were in New York as well, is that right?
Yes, I moved to New York about 10 years ago for undergrad, and I've just stayed here ever since. I'm currently in Brooklyn now.
So clearly spiritual values were very important to you. Are they still important to you now?
Yeah, definitely. I think there was a long time where I, because of how my gender and sexuality was received by my parents, they didn't receive it very well. I kind of spent a lot of my late teenage years, college years, rejecting this whole idea of spirituality because I connected it to the way that they responded to me. But there was so much beauty about how my parents and my mother in particular came to spirituality, and it created so much space for her to be her own idea of what a Black woman could be. In a lot of ways, now that I'm older and I'm able to like look back on it, I think the way that I wanted to create space for myself and to exist as a Black queer person, I learned from how she, you know, she didn't mind that she was different from other people around her, and that didn't stop her from doing what she believed and loving the things that she loved, and she loved more than anything her idea of God. Yeah, I learned so much about it even without even knowing it. And it took me a while to gain that appreciation of how that was tied to her spirituality. There wasn't a lot that could shake her from her beliefs, and her beliefs ultimately were rooted in love, even though I think there were a lot of times it was expressed in ways that felt unloving when we had these tensions around my queerness. But now that I'm able to see, even within those tensions, she was still working around something, and maybe she just didn't, she hadn't worked through it yet, which allows me to give her more space and grace for that. And I'm able to do that because of, you know, knowing that this is how her belief system works. And so the spirituality plays very heavily in how I approach my queerness and Blackness and relationships in general, because I think that we have to believe in things that are bigger than us, and we have to give people grace and space to make their own way to whatever that thing is. And in the case of my mother, that meant working through our own tensions, and knowing that at the core of it, there was this love that we both shared together. And I think that love is a part of spirituality for me.
That's so beautifully put. And we are talking with Hari Ziad about his memoir, Black Boy Out of Time. Tell us a little bit more about how your mother related to your queerness. What were her struggles with it, and then your struggles with how she dealt with it? How did you guys work on that knot between the two of you, and were you ultimately able to untie it?
So when I first told my parents I was queer, I was in college, and they just had a very, it was actually interesting because I thought my father would react to it worse than my mother, but it was actually my mother who was like, oh, this is your schooling that is doing this to you, and like, we're not going to support it anymore, and like refused to sign off on loans, and really was just doing whatever she was like grasping for straws because she felt like she'd lost control of the situation. My siblings were there as like a mitigating factor and were like talking to her like, this isn't okay. And were very supportive throughout this whole process. And like I said, because so much of this was rooted in like this misguided idea of love, I never felt like that was going to be the end of our relationship. But there were a couple of years where we just didn't really talk as much. And it would take, I think, me being able to approach that from a different perspective of like, not just that, you know, this is completely unacceptable and I don't want anything to do with this. Although I do think it is, that's not something that queer children should have to deal with. But also like there was work on my end that I needed to do towards helping her through that process. And so I had to do a lot of healing myself to get to a point where I could do that, where I wasn't just operating from a place of just hurt, while still being able to acknowledge the hurt that there was. And in order to do that, I had to remember that growing up, like that wasn't always my experience with my mother and gender expression. Like I said, we were homeschooled when I was younger, and so much of that experience was my mother just allowing us to be. And so that was my first taste really of being able to just experience and express myself in the world without having these outside restrictions on it. And so in so many ways, that's the foundation of my queerness. And so I had to appreciate her for that, even though there was a shift that happened when she, I think, was just afraid of how the world would respond to that. And so yeah, once I did some of that work, and a lot of that came from the inner child work we spoke about earlier, I was able to approach it with a lens on what I appreciated from my mother and how she raised us and how that wasn't in conflict with my queerness and how we could work through together the things that were. And so one of our last conversations we had about it, she just started crying and she was just like, I just don't know what to do. Like, I don't know how to respond to this, but I'm trying. And I believed that. I think she was trying and she just didn't have the tools. And if I wasn't going to be there and working with her to find those tools, which thankfully before she passed, we spent a lot of time working together and she, you know, got to know my partner and she would call and ask about him. And I think she was still working on it when she passed, but that was all that I needed is so that confirmation that she was willing to do that work. And we were doing it together, which was really beautiful.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's really a gift to be able to come to that kind of resolution, even if most of the resolution is in yourself because of what you've done. And certainly some of it was hers. Now, Hari Ziad, there's a whole other theme in this book that I think is also really important, and that is how you write about focusing, how you write of your life through the lens of the experience of being Black in America. There's a word you use a lot in the book, and that's carceral, as in incarceration, the carceral state we know about. You talk about carceral logics and how that's impacted your family and how you relate to the world, including to yourself and your own definitions of manhood. So break it down for us. What are carceral logics, and what has been the impact of that on you and on other Black people?
Sure. Carceral logics are just ideas that uphold the prison and police system state that we live under. And those ideas are rooted in punitivity. So we approach conflict in this country and elsewhere with the idea that you can punish a harm doer and that will fix the issue. And that's also how we approach conflicts within our families. It's how we approach conflicts within ourselves. And so what I'm hoping to do with the book is to show that our issue isn't just with, you know, the physical prison structures and police officers that are on our streets, although that's a big part of it, but the things that allow them to exist and for us to rely on them to, quote unquote, keep our communities safe are the same things that we adopt in our interpersonal relationships and in our relationships with ourselves. And that I think is very restricting to us being healthy and whole, particularly for Black people, because as you know, we're usually the ones who are getting punished when we're in conflict with other folks. And so, yeah, carceral logics are in the ways that, you know, when you make a mistake, you beat yourself up and you think that it's bad, and bad and good are binary and always in opposition. And we don't think about things with more nuance. It's in how you might react to, it's how I reacted to my mother for a long period of time because of the conflict that we had, rejecting her completely instead of being able to see her as a fully fleshed human being who has space to grow and not just be stuck in this this role of being someone who's harmed me. And so my goal in writing the book was to show how carceral logics show up throughout our lives and what we can do to approach conflict through a lens of healing versus punishment. What does it mean to when someone harms you, to only move towards the thing that's going to be healing? And so often that thing that's healing isn't going to look at like punishment at all. It could look like a variety of things. And so that is why carceral logics was such an important part of the book.
Yeah. And you say when it comes to healing, it's not just about healing individuals, but also that you say there need to be communal healing practices. What do you mean by that? And give us some examples.
Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the biggest disservices to our health is that we move in this country as if we're individuals and if our health is not connected to anyone else's health. And I think anyone who's grown up in a family and a community knows that there's limits to that. But we're not used to operating from an idea that like if someone who lives next to me is healthy, then that's going to affect my health as well. And so when you're operating from a lens on the community, there's a lot of give and take that you might give. It might not always be you as an individual who's receiving something immediately in that moment. But because you're in community with someone, because you're in a family with someone, their healing is going to impact your own. And I think that is clearly evident in families. I don't think that I would ever be able to do the healing work that I needed to do myself around my queerness fully without pulling my mother into that process, because so much of that were things that were tied to her. And I think in general, that is how we should approach the harm that we've experienced, is that a lot of it is tied to other people, and they have to heal through that as well in order for us to feel whole and to feel safe in community with them. Because we can't just pretend like we're not in community with other people.
It seems to me that the murder of George Floyd was really an inflection point, or at least I hope it was an inflection point for opening up some space for possible healing in America of our terribly racist history. And this is not to say like, oh, it's so easy and now we're all going to be cool. Not at all. But that I just would like to know from you, what will it take to heal America of its racism and to heal the experience and the trauma of Black people who have been suffering for 400 years?
Right. Yeah. I think that's the million-dollar question. But I think, I hope that, you know, this is a moment where we're seeing some work towards that. I'm always a little hesitant to claim that early, and we can see already, like, I mean, now it's back in the news, but there was like a very good period of time where, you know, there was lots of discussion about abolish the police, defund the police, and what that meant in the aftermath of George Floyd's murder. And we saw that kind of teetered off. And now that the trial is here, we're having more of those conversations. And so I'm always interested in like how we sustain that beyond just the immediate, like, visceral reaction to things. Because that's my fear, is that we have this trial, we have this situation, and then like people are forced to pay attention, but there's nothing really that forces people to continue once the trial is over. And so I'm really optimistic that we are in a moment where we can push towards that, but I think we have to be really vigilant about not resting on our laurels. And I think we do that by having these conversations within our communities, not just through the media. Media can be a really important tool to do this, but I think the way that we convince people of abolition and the necessity of it is to show how it works in our everyday life, to show how it works in our interactions with our neighbors, in our families. That's going to be the best way to convince people that there is a possible other way to deal with harm. And until people are able to imagine what that looks like and see what that looks like, I think we'll always butt up against, you know, the limitations of these narratives, because I don't think as a country we are able to imagine an alternative fully. It's still very difficult. And so my work is to just show up within my communities, show up in my everyday life, in my family, modeling what healing looks like versus punishment when we're addressing harms. And that's really difficult work, but it's work that we have to commit to over and over every day.
So when you talk about abolition, what you're talking about is an approach that is rooted in healing and restoration rather than punishment. Is that right?
Yes.
Well, you know, we've just touched the surface of your wonderful memoir, Black Boy Out of Time, Hari Ziad. It's really been a privilege to talk with you today on Writer's Voice.
Same here. Thank you so much.
Hari Ziad is a writer, screenwriter, and the editor-in-chief of the online journal Race Baiter. They are a 2021 Lambda Literary Fellow, and their writing has been featured in Gawker, Out, The Guardian, Huffington Post, and Ebony, among other publications. Next week on Writer's Voice, it's all about math and astrophysics. We talk with Milo Beckman about his book, Math Without Numbers, and with Giles Sparrow about his book, A History of the Universe in 21 Stars. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.